Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show, episode number 45, is a celebration of the power of poetry. We hear from an innovative performance artist named Janahi, a decorated and passionate educator, Dr. Precious Simonette, and her award-winning slam poet proteges, the Viking Freedom Writers. With grace and humility, our guests share some of the most personal stories and heartfelt poems and discuss the beauty of self-expression through spoken word. This poignant episode will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. At the heart of the Freedom Writers story is discovery. A discovery of words and the power that words have to inspire, to educate, and to transform lives. My students were changed by the words they read and by their journey to tell their own stories. The Freedom Writers use words to express themselves, to affirm their identity, and to give voice to those who felt they didn't have a voice. Our featured guest today is on her own journey of discovery, a journey of poetry in which she's not only finding herself, but is helping others find their voices as well. I was lucky enough to meet Janahi at this year's Story Conference held in Nashville, and was blown away by the power of her prose and how she made her art collaborative with her audience. At the start of her presentation, Janahi passed a clipboard down the aisle and asked attendees to write a single word, phrase, or even a sentence in sequence after each other, what she calls a potluck poem. As Janahi read the audience's words, I was amazed by how cohesive and powerful this collective poem could be. While we couldn't recreate the magic of a potluck poem for you on a podcast, Janahi was able to share with us her insight into her process, how she finds the perfect words for her poetry, and how we can make poetry leap from the page. Without further ado, here's my conversation with performance artist and activist, Janahi. There are moments at conferences where I am spellbound, where my jaw drops to the ground, where the hairs on my arm stand up, and I just want to meet the person standing on the stage. And that was what happened to me recently. I was in Nashville, an incredible conference called Story. The lights came down low, and there was this vision of this gorgeous woman in stature and word, and you could have heard a pin drop. We laughed at the right places, we cried at the right places, we stomped our feet, and then there was a line around the building to meet her. And in that room, what she did was transform time and space with words and images and metaphors. She is an activist. She is an ardent storyteller. But more than anything, I think she's a change agent with words. And so to have a podcast that's all about the celebration of words, it is such an honor and gift to be sitting beside you. And just like I was in the audience, my hairs are standing up, my jaw's about to drop, and I am just wrapped with what you're going to say next. So I want to introduce you to our international audience. Say hello to those near and afar, to our audience, Janahi.
Thank you so, so much. That is hello to all of you. That is, I think, one of the most beautiful introductions I've ever heard. I know that they can't see me, but I'm here blushing. That was absolutely stunning. Thank you so much. And it's such an honor to be sitting next to you.
What I love about your name is that it was given to you. And I know it is Arabic. Yes. Can you tell our audience the importance of names and the importance of your name?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Janahi, and it means my wings in Arabic. And I am Egyptian, and so my family has this tradition where when you name someone or when you give something a name, that is the fate that it will have. And so my mother and my grandparents were really particular about my name, and Janahi, meaning that there is a message greater than myself that I am supposed to pass on. And I don't know if I'll ever fill those shoes, but that's what my name tells me that my fate will be. They're big shoes that I hope to fill with my art and my craft and my being and my sense of purpose in this world.
One of the things that you did at Story that we can't do on a podcast, which was brilliant, is your potluck poetry.
Yes.
And what was so exciting is you had people in the audience contribute words. And then they gave you those words at the end, and yes, you constructed a poem in real time.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about how that came to light.
You know, it's very odd to call yourself a poet for a living. It's not a common occupation that people say, like, hey, that's what I do for a living, and that's what I am. And I had so many people tell me as I was touring and traveling the country that, like, I wish I could be as good, you know, with words, and I wish I could be a poet, and I wish I could write poetry, and I've always really loved poetry. And I thought, well, wait, you can, right? And I, as a spoken word artist, sort of live in this very different world that page poetry is sometimes an art form that seems inaccessible to us, but that spoken word came along much later and was created so that it could be more accessible to the masses, right? So like these 60s, 70s beat poets that came out with this new way of doing poetry, which is what we now know as spoken word. And the potluck poem really came as a way to make poetry and make the performance more accessible to the audience and to invite them into the performance. And it happens in real time. So what I do is I usually write the first line, and it'll be something very vague, like I am, or I remember, or I feel. And from then I surrender total trust to the audience, and I let them write whatever they like on that potluck poem. And at the end of my performance or talk or what have you, the potluck poem makes its way back to me. And what I have is a poem that is entirely written by strangers. The poem is a collaboration among strangers, and at the end of the show, I get to perform the audience's poem. I get to share with them their work. And I think in that way, you know, in very much the same way that people bring dishes to a potluck, it really is a celebration of what we can do when we are willing to surrender ourselves and be vulnerable in real time with other people, and that beautiful art can be made in the moment, and that really all it takes is the willingness to surrender to the magic of that moment. And I'm always floored. I'm always in awe of how beautiful these poems turn out, especially since they're usually not written by poets.
I think what you allowed the audience to do when I witnessed it is to feel daring and bold.
Yeah, and that's my hope for it.
The other thing I find so fascinating about you is your willingness to share vulnerable topics with an audience of strangers. Mm-hmm. Because when the performance is over, we're no longer strangers. We know you, and I feel like you know us.
Yes.
So talk about vulnerability in the art of spoken word.
Oh, geez, this question takes me way back. So when I started in the spoken word world, poets, when you're sitting at an open mic or a slam, and a poetry slam is sort of like this poetry competition, it's like a rap battle, except we're much nicer to each other because we're poets. So, but we all sit in this room, and each poet takes their turn going up to the mic, and poets have these expressions, right? So sometimes they'll yell, get free, poet, or sometimes they'll yell, like, damn, that was a great line, but other times...
Or they'll snap their fingers.
Yeah. Or they'll snap their fingers, or they'll clap their hands. And I think, you know, one of the things that I grew up listening to is get free, poet, right? Get free. And another expression that they have is the wound needs a witness, right? Yeah. And so before you get onto the mic, or when you leave the mic, somebody is sure to yell out, the wound needs a witness. And when we look at the word vulnerability, what it really means, you know, when we look at the history of the word, its etymology, it means the wound. And so I grew up with this concept of spoken word being a bearing of wounds. And that when we allow ourselves to do that, we invite others into the wound, and that is how the wound heals. That wounds do not heal in isolation, they heal in community with one another. They heal in relationship with one another, and they heal by our ability and our capacity to speak our truth. And so for me, every time I sit down to write, I'm thinking about, what is the story that I am afraid to tell? And I sit down and I commit myself to writing that story. I commit myself to writing the story that I am most afraid to tell in that moment. And what I find is that the first time I get on stage, I'm so damn nervous. I want to, like, piss my pants and vomit.
But you're so confident.
You're the epitome of confidence. No, it's a lie. It's a performance lie. I've had a lot of years to, like, hide all my nervous tics. So, I'm, like, inside shaking. I'm pretty nervous up there.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm terrified every moment of every day.
Yeah.
And I looked at you on that stage, larger than life, and I just thought you were the epitome of dignity and grace and poise.
Oh, you're too kind.
But you would have never known in a million years that you were nervous.
Yeah, I've had a lot of practice hiding the nervous tics, you know.
That's good to know for kids.
I think that comes with so much time being a performer is that you learn to honor your nerves for what they are. They are there to help you, right? In that moment of adrenaline where you need to perform, they are there to help you, right? They serve a purpose, but also I don't want the audience to see that, right? Like, they don't need to see my hand shaking and, you know, me having dry mouth. They don't need to see that. So I've learned to hide those things, and I've learned to use my nerves. And there is a moment in performance, like I know we were talking about vulnerability, there's a moment where I just surrender, right? And that requires so much vulnerability too. And the moment I let myself surrender to the audience every time without fail, they carry me. Right? They carry me and they don't say anything during the performance, but you can feel this unsaid interaction that, like, we got you.
I felt myself leaning in.
Oh.
And your cadence, I almost wanted you to read me a bedtime story.
Oh, I'd be happy to read you a bedtime story.
But what I'm so excited about for our audience in particular is we like to surround ourselves with wounded healers.
Yeah.
And a lot of the students in the classrooms we serve are kids who are afraid of their voice because English may not be their first language.
Right.
Or they're afraid of their ethnic background because of oftentimes the things they've heard on television that stereotype and stigmatize. What I loved about what you did in your moment of vulnerability is take us backwards to go forward with your mother. Can you talk about an ode to your mother and why on that stage with 1,000 people leaning in, why you had us all crying and sobbing and standing on our feet because we wanted to celebrate you?
Yeah.
But celebrating you was really celebrating your mom and all those other mothers who we
absolutely
can see and celebrate.
So I grew up Egyptian American, and I was born here, but both of my parents were immigrants, and they came here from Egypt. And when I was young, I remember always feeling like the outcast. Not only did I never see another Egyptian, but I never saw like another Arab in general. I mean, I don't know where the rest of them live, really, but I only came into contact with them like very rarely, and only in very small communities of us. And I just remember thinking, nobody is like me, and how isolating that felt and how alienating it felt. And that even when I felt assimilated into American culture, there was always this sense of otherness. And so the poem that you saw, a story, actually came about. I was standing in a cashier line, and this guy asks me where I'm from, and I say I'm from America, and he says, no, where are you really from? And then I have to say, okay, well, my parents are Egyptian. And in the conversation, he says, oh, you speak perfect English. And I walked away from that moment absolutely silent. I was so shaken by what he had said. And I don't think he had any ill intentions, but I just remember thinking, oh man, I wish you knew. I wish you knew where this English came from and who gave it to me and why it was so important to a family of immigrants. And so the poem really came as a wish that I could take him back and that I could have him meet my mother and that I could show him the sacrifice she made for me to have perfect English. The poem is really just like an invitation to take people back and that by going back, we can move forward. Mm. So that is where that poem came from. And it very much came from a sense of feeling othered.
And I love, as an audience member, the way I felt then and how our listener will feel listening to you, I pictured that store. I pictured that gentleman. I wanted to vilify him.
Oh.
But then I also pictured you as a little girl, and I pictured your mom. Mm-hmm. And I just had this visceral reaction that I wanted to hug her.
Oh.
Because I felt that the journey that she went on is a journey that so many people go on in our country, in America, but globally. Would you do us the honor by painting this picture as I probably weep, as I did the first time I heard it, so we can see her and so we can celebrate her?
Oh, absolutely. It would be my pleasure. And so this is a dedication to my mother and to every immigrant and refugee. And this poem is called The Letter P. When the man in the cashier line tells me I speak perfect English, I want to tell him, that when I was young, I laughed at the way my mother said the word perfect. Because there is no equivalent for the letter P in the Arabic alphabet, the word perfect was impossible for my mother to pronounce. The last time I made that joke was the first time I made my mother cry, and the first time I remember her crying, her eyes filled with something I could not understand. I knew I was to blame, how I wished I could pray myself mute by morning as she tucked me into bed. In the days that followed, I overheard my mother practicing the letter P everywhere. She would fix her posture, close her eyes, give it a try, but the letter P would always only sound like its not so distant cousin, the letter B. She would drill the difference between B and P every night before she went to sleep. BP, 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 brush, she'd say. Toothpaste, she'd say. Book, bed, pray, sleep, she'd say, until her lips begged for pause for me. The letter P is easy. The letter P is as painless as pouring water from a pitcher. For her, the letter P is a reminder of the pain I had caused in plain English. It is the reason she apologizes to people for not being able to say people. The reason people ask her if she is from here and tell her to go back home when she is already home. The letter P is the accent that makes her feel less American. The guilt sticks like a talon in my gut. When the man in the cashier line tells me I speak perfect English, he says, "Where are you from?" I say, "Here." He says, "No, where are you really from?" I say, "My parents are from Egypt." He says, "Oh, you don't look Egyptian." I say, "Have you ever even seen an Egyptian?" He says, "Only in the movies and on the news." He asks me again, "So, you're American?" The question makes me want to scrape the English from my mouth, makes me want to speak to him in my mother's tongue so he will know what it is like to feel like a stranger in his hometown. When the man in the cashier line tells me I speak perfect English, I want to tell him how my mother made perfect English a priority, how she made me trace each letter from the English alphabet until my fingers calloused, made me copy passages out of the English dictionary 6 times over until it was perfect, until each word perched on lined paper like a pelican ready for flight, every pen dried of its ink, every paper was filled, every spelling test at school a perfect score. She promised that one day I would understand. She said, "I want you to be better than me." She meant, "I don't want other Americans to make you feel less American." So when the man in the cashier line tells me I speak perfect English, I feel less American. So I pretend I am young again, running home after school, spelling test in hand, imagining just how proud my mother will be when I open the door to say, "Look, Mama, it's perfect with a capital P." Thank you. Oh, there's a few people sobbing in the room.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
I'm speechless again. I am sobbing again. And I just want this to be heard. I just want this to be celebrated. So words can stir and
absolutely,
words can poke and prod. And did you realize that you had this gift, this beautiful gift with a big red bow?
Oh, no, no. And I think that's the beauty of a gift, is that you don't know you have it until it just smacks you in the face, right? And so often people ask me, well, you know, who decides to be a spoken word poet? And I say, nobody. Nobody in their right mind decides to be a spoken word poet for a living. And I truly, this art form found me. Truly.
But I love the image of you on a stage with the Roots.
Yeah.
With Angela Davis. Michelle Obama.
Big gifts. Big gifts. I was so blessed to have these experiences. And I... this art form found me. The time that I found it, I was actually going through a really, really painful time in my life. And I was sitting in my room and something just said, "Pick up a pen." And I said, "Oh, that's silly. You know, I'm not going to write a fucking poem." And it said, no, pick up a pen. And I picked up a pen and I picked up a notebook and I wrote what would eventually become my first poem. And I never even liked poetry. I never thought a great deal of poetry. I thought it was silly and sentimental and stupid, and I would throw it by the wayside. I thought there were more important things in the world than poetry, than poems. And then this art form came, and then I became a poet. And then I always tell people this art form literally saved my life, that I do not know what I would be doing if not for poetry.
But clearly you have great empathy because you're also a therapist.
Yeah, well, I try.
So I love that you can be a great listener, an active listener, but also a woman who can weave together these sentences, these octaves, the cadence to go high, to go low, to punctuate. Mm-hmm. So what is that like for you to figure out the perfect word for the perfect poem?
I agonize over the perfect words, as every writer does. I agonize. I spend hours trying to figure out the perfect word and the perfect line and the perfect cadence. But for me, my writing process is very much a process of collection. Right? I tell people that, yes, I am a storyteller, but first and foremost, I am a story collector. And so much of my job is about keeping an ear out for the poem, that the poem, I trust, will find me, and it will find me in strange places. Sometimes a line heard eavesdropping over a stranger's conversation, sometimes something a friend says, a message that is so timely, sometimes something from a teacher or mentor or a child playing in the playground. And I keep my ear out for the poem, and when the poem hits me, I know, because it shakes me. And so it's not so much about finding intellectually what is the perfect word with the perfect number of syllables. It's more about what shakes my spirit in that moment, and that there's the, I keep my sensors up. And when the muse hits me, when the spirit comes, when a higher power just says, go write this fucking poem right now, I go and I do it and I heed the call. And, you know, words are the medium, but really, really soul is the art. Soul is the art.
So let me ask you some questions about, with this new opportunity to stand on a stage, whether it's a glorious college campus or a conference. We're in Baltimore, your hometown, for the National Conference of Teachers of English. These are your people.
My people. I love them so much. English teachers and I was telling you this earlier, but English teachers saved my life.
So let's transformed talk about that. Me. Let's talk about taking an idea. You said it earlier. We've interviewed guests before who, when they were in a class, hated a specific subject and then became celebrated. So there was a scientist we interviewed who went on to be the backdrop of Jurassic Park. But he failed science. And now he's a professor. He's a paleontologist. Wow. We had a historian who's written more best-selling books who hated history when he was in school. So for kids who hated the idea of poetry, when it's in an anthology, when it's in a textbook, how did you make poetry dance and sing and leap out of a page?
You know, poetry never resonated with me because when I was sitting in English class, it was always old white men. I was learning about old white men who were writing poetry that had absolutely nothing to do with me or my life or my experiences.
My students call them dead white guys in tights.
Dead white guys in tights. That is the perfect, that is the perfect way to talk about it. They truly. How can we expect for a piece of poetry to resonate with someone when it is so distant from us and our experiences, right? When that poetry is not a representation of our lived experience. And so for me, the turning point, English teachers who said, okay, I want to take you under my wing and I want to give you the work that resonates with you. And next thing you know, I was reading Khalil Gibran, right? The Lebanese poet who wrote The Prophet, who has a poem for every feeling you can imagine. And then I saw, you know, later I turned on my television and I saw HBO Def Jam Poetry, which was like this big show back in like the 90s and early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken. And there were all these poets
Most
of colors. All these poets of color who were getting up and doing these poems about, you know, revolution and racism and what it means to be a woman and just the cadence and the beauty of the oral tradition of this art form. It just hit me like a big bag of bricks. And it was the first time that I had ever seen poets of color. It was the first time that I had ever heard poetry performed and recited out loud. And that to me was like, whoa, I didn't even know this existed. I didn't even know this was poetry. And at that moment, I thought to myself very passively, that's kind of cool. Maybe I can do that. And then I think my subconscious just sort of buried it somewhere and was like, one day.
But there's nothing passive about you. I'm sitting next to you. And even when you talk, I'm still teary-eyed. But your whole body moves.
Oh, thank you.
So there's you're anything but passive.
Oh.
You're very much of the moment. And as your words sing, so does your body.
Oh.
And it makes the audience kind of move and sway and
lean
in. Oh,
thank you. I've never realized that I sway when I speak. It's probably, you know, I think I like to tell people that I come from a family of storytellers where some of my best memories are really sitting at my grandmother's feet or my grandfather's feet, and they're braiding my hair and they're telling me stories, and they're so good at it that the tea kettle could have been whistling at full volume in the background and you would never know, because that's how good of a storyteller they were. And I remember just sitting at my grandmother's and grandfather's feet and thinking to myself, man, to have that kind of energy to just sort of whisk people into this other world that isn't real, or that sometimes is, but to just move people in that way, it feels like an alternate universe. And I thought to myself, what a gift, what a gift. And so I hope that I'm just half as good of a storyteller as they are and as they were.
Speaking of gifts, what I love to ask our guests to do is often to picture a younger version of themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you could give a gift to a beautiful Egyptian girl in a class in some corner struggling with letters, maybe struggling with the letter P like your mother, mm-hmm. wanting to be seen, wanting to be heard, wanting to matter, mm-hmm. what kind of gift would you give them with words?
That is such an amazing question. I would write down the message that I wish someone wrote down for me. And it's very simple. And forgive me if this sounds cliche, but I remember growing up, I always needed this reminder. I wish someone had wrote it down. And so if I could give that little girl a gift, it would be three simple words. And they would be, you are worthy. You are worthy. And so many people in this world will do their darndest to tell you that you are not. And I would want to remind that girl every single day to look herself in the mirror and say, you are so worthy and so capable. And block out all of the noise that tells you you aren't. And so those three simple words, I think, are so powerful. You are worthy. I am worthy. Right? And I am here, and I have a purpose to serve.
I think my last question is, you so beautifully and eloquently spoke to the young girl who was worthy.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes we preach to our choir. We preach to the people who seek us out.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that you're a contrarian. I love that you are a Trojan horse. I love that you want to change the system. And so in order to change the system, you got to bust down a door.
Mm-hmm.
What would you want to say to someone who did not know your name, did not know about slam poetry, did not know about this art form, how important it is? And how do we get that message in your words and others' words to them?
You know, if people didn't know that I was Egyptian or that I was a poet, and if you were to remove every facet of my identity, right, all my phenotypes and all of the things that make me a unique individual, for lack of a better word, I think I would tell people that, you know, when you erase all of those things, I'm flesh and blood, and so are you. And I think often we forget the power in that. We forget the connection in that. We forget the empathy in that. And I know that you've heard me say this before, but that empathy is being in feeling with other people. And I would ask for someone to be in feeling with me. And I would ask that they invite me to be in feeling with them. I think so often we get stuck in these very limited narratives. We get stuck in these story tropes, and we forget that the person on the other end of that is truly flesh and blood, with feeling. So I would tell them to come out and join me for a cup of tea so that we can have a chat and so that we can get to know each other beyond all the stigmas and stereotypes, but who we are as human beings. Take off all the labels and take off all the guards and the defenses and have some tea together.
I'm so grateful to Janahi for sharing her profound and poetic words with us. My dear listeners, may we find the courage to tell the stories that we are most afraid to tell. May we remember that we are all worthy. And as Janahi so beautifully embodies, may we all listen with open ears so that we can empathize with one another. We now have a special segment from one of our beloved Freedom Writer teachers, former Miami-Dade Teacher of the Year, Dr. Precious Simonette, along with her acclaimed students at Miami Norland Senior High School. You'll hear from Prophet Van Saint, Janae Anchenor, Najee Sweetness Maxwell, and Jean Dufrancois. These celebrated poets call themselves the Viking Freedom Writers and are multiple state championship winners of Young Talent Big Dreams, Piano Slam, AXO, and so many other competitions. As they boldly bare their souls in their provocative pieces, I invite you, just like these poets, to consider how you too can use words to express yourself and become an advocate for those who haven't yet found their voice.
My name is Prophet.
What got me into spoken word and poetry is the fact that when you write your story on paper and you can see your past experiences in a tangible sense, it gives you something to reflect on. It gives you a reference point to reflect on, and you could either see how far you've come. You can see things about you that you may want to change, things about you that you may want to grow into. It's quite the reflective and introspective journey. So we was able to bring our vulnerability to other people through performing, and they would be vulnerable. And I just realized just how much of an impact that had on other people. When you're younger, you see the world as a black and white thing. The older I started getting, the more I realized there's always a story behind whatever you're looking at. There's always conditions and things of that nature that is responsible for your environment and why it looks the way it does on a systematic level. Like, there is more to prison than just walls and bars, you understand me? There are things that if you're not careful, you can be a slave or a prisoner too. These were concepts that I felt like needed to be expressed, and I tried to embody all of that in my poem that you all will hear, so.
This is a poem entitled Social Prisoners. What if I said slaves work best when they ain't know that they were slaves? What if I said citizens comply best when they think it's a democracy? What if I told you America is more like Alcatraz? Now, before you answer those rhetorical questions, keep in mind, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. Just like that, our rights get silenced. Never to be acknowledged in a court of law, we struggle to stand against broken systems, fixed on giving fixed mindsets, so we never think twice about a change or revolution. We become prisoners before we commit crimes, guilty until proven innocent, school to prison, pipelines, guidelines, is to guide minds to jail times. Students become statistics. Suspicion equals suspension. Until dropouts get dropped in jail cells, orange jumpsuits or school uniforms now. High school abortions and college miscarriages only get scholarships to cage daycares, hoping commissary labeled as tuition gets paid. Not get enough money on my books for that PhD. What's that? That's that. Properly hidden discrimination, zero tolerance policies, policing marginalized communities, systematic racism, reconstruction requirements until these laws target minorities more than cops do, spilling black ink on white concrete like pens do. These cursive lives become signed syllables, becoming salesmen that were tricked into selling their education for jail. Get it, salesmen, pack penitentiaries, and when we stop buying this American dream, they sell us and realize the irony of that being the only thing free about this country. Our taxes go up. We pay generational fees for speaking up against this corrupt corporation as they kill our social activists and give them holidays to give us a false sense of apology. Happy Martin Luther King Day. Social security. When that we believe so hard, we become social prisoners. Sitting on the porches of our houses on house arrest. paying commissary labeled as rent and mortgage in these Section 8 county jails, fighting over food stamps and WIC-approved products until homicide is the product approved by wicked people who profit as prison owners. You would think that they pour 2% truth, 2% milk on textbooks the way history gets whitewashed, making culturally relevant curriculums elusive so it's easier for them to strip our crowns from us, kill kings for dreaming, lock up Fresh Prince because it fill up banks. I'm from Florida, not New York, but I seen how Queens wish the black man hadn't been the big apple of her eyes, breaking homes as if they were built with Legos, yet we build up problems we never let go. Separated on different cell blocks within poverty-stricken hoods until gentrification hands out eviction notices. No one notices. No warnings given. We're just given. Social security numbers as our inmate IDs. We have no idea regarding the sinister systematic setbacks we face until jails and Jim Crow photobomb mugshots, leading to the camouflage that makes us get out of our sunken place and realize the untold case of mass incarceration, or rather side effect of it, is mental imprisonment. Setting limitations on mindsets, boundaries on the way the brain thinks. These flaws spawn self-destructive patterns within people, making success such a foreign experience that achieving anything seems against the law. And as I read the Constitution as inmate mail, I can't help but ask myself, what if slaves worked best because they didn't know they were slaves? What if citizens complied best because they thought it was a democracy? What if America is Alcatraz?
One thing that I absolutely love about what I teach is the fact that kids get the opportunity to know that their voice matters. I think that kids should have the opportunity to write their stories and scream it as loud as they possibly can.
Our words are powerful. The word can destroy or change someone's life.
Nothing listens to you better than a blank sheet of paper. Pour your heart into it. You could be the editor later or try to find a better concept later. Write your heart out first.
You have to know that it's not just about you. I know there's going to be someone that hears me and understands me, and I just might change someone's perspective on something. You have to think of it as more than just yourself.
I love when my students are able to get in front of any audience and speak their hearts, because they are galvanizing the community together. I'm constantly inspired, constantly motivated. I've seen my kids move so many different audiences, have people crying, have people running up to them like, oh my gosh, like I saw this, I want to be like you. Like, and that to me is a beautiful thing, because they are building community with each piece they perform.
Going to a slam, right? Everybody's coming and they're presenting their pieces. And when I say pieces, I mean pieces of themselves. Pieces of their experiences, their perspectives. People from all over the world use the same thing that I do as an outlet to be heard. So the piece that I'm going to perform today is called Pride. I'm so proud of myself. I've accomplished things beyond my imagination and succeeded in ways I couldn't have possibly dreamt of. I've shared my story with the world and fully accepted myself for who I am, but I cannot say that traveling down that road was the smoothest trip I've ever taken. Hitting so many bumps along the way, I started to lose things. Things I couldn't turn back for. People I couldn't imagine my life without. I've lost so many so-called friends and family just because I wanted to be myself. Because I chose to be happy. Pride can be the most exhilarating yet devastating experience known to man, and my pride cost me my world. See, the family I once had ripped at its seams. And although it seems that these things only happen in movie scenes, it was proven that the way that their character changed wasn't an act. They tried to change me, making me fight in a battle I've already won. I don't need a rematch. I've already beaten the confusion, tussled with the denial, and brawled with the acceptance. I won. It's not me who needs to change. Are y'all sure I'm the problem here? My rider dies would rather die than ride with me. I'm good. I can ride along with God on my journey of pride and accepting myself who I am. If I can't be happy the way they want me to be, then I can't be happy with them. How y'all signing terms and conditions to unconditional love? Saying that my sin is gonna send me to hell, but your sin is bringing you closer to God. Nah, that's not the God I know. He doesn't eeny, meeny, miny, mo and pick a sinner by the toe. The God I praise wouldn't exclude me. I'm too gay to fit in with the Christians, but too Christian to fit in with the gays. I'm confused. Why is everyone so interested in something they don't support? Bringing up my sexuality every time I come around as if it was a greeting. As if my sexual preference is the only thing that really matters. No, my life matters. My choice matters, but your opinion does not matter. The only opinion I depend on is Jesus. Says pride is standing in the way of friendships that sunk a long time ago, and I'll make sure you drown in your decisions. You can shampoo away all of your conditional I love yous. It's crystal clear that I can do this by myself. I'll continue to accomplish things beyond my imagination. Tell the world my story. Continue to fully accept myself, who I am, and no matter what road I travel down, I'll stand strong with pride.
Educators have to be real. They have to be honest that social injustice and inequality exists, specifically in our schools. And I think if you want to help to erase that, you have to bring those voices to the table. You have to elevate those student voices that are experiencing those inequities and social injustices. And slam poetry, poetry writing, period, helps students to do that. When they are able to insert who they are into something that they consider to be extremely foreign, you are helping students to understand, okay, I do have something to say about this, and it's okay that I say it. Even if I don't agree with everybody else, it's completely fine. I want my students and students around the world to know that they can break the status quo. My students were able to understand that vulnerability is a strength. And in the midst of them being vulnerable, they have become extraordinary activists and advocates for social issues that truly, truly matter. And they have a seat at the table. And in fact, they created their own table and they're having these courageous conversations by themselves. So I'm extremely proud of them because of that.
That concludes our show this week. We're sad to share that this is our last episode of the 2019 season, but we're excited for what lies ahead. I'm so grateful to all of our extraordinary guests from the first season and the second. And I want to thank you, our beloved listeners, from the bottom of my heart for being an important part of our Freedom Rider family. We wish all of you the happiest of holidays and invite you to stay tuned in the new year for news about our third season of the Freedom Riders podcast. We already have a slate of world-class guests lined up, including sports icon and activist Billie Jean King, CBS correspondent and the producer of On the Road, Steve Hartman, and beloved actor, director, and the producer of our film Freedom Riders, the one and only Danny DeVito. Until we launch Season 3 in 2020, we encourage you to dig through our archive of past episodes and possibly binge listen to these soul-enriching stories. With 45 marquee episodes, plus 5 episodes from our behind-the-scenes feature, Freedom Rider 2020, we have over 40 hours of premium content for you to enjoy with your family and friends during the holidays. We encourage you to listen to our guests' empowering words and have courageous conversations together. We also are so excited to share that the Freedom Riders and I will be featured on NBC News third hour of the Today Show to celebrate the 20th anniversary edition of the Freedom Rider's Diary and our documentary, Stories from the Heart. You can tune in to watch us live on the Today Show December 12th. And if you haven't yet seen our documentary, it is now available to stream on PBS's website and will continue to air nationally on PBS. I'm so grateful for these opportunities to spread the Freedom Rider's story and empower new generations to find their voice and share their stories with the world. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Serrier and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.